Hello, come in. Lie down. Relax. Take a deep breath in. And now breathe out. We'll be your therapists today. You're listening to Triathlon Therapy.
That's too much time. Look at Steve McKenna. Steve, what are you doing, Steve? That's too much time. Advantage Reed.
Okay, everyone. This podcast is brought to you by rpgcoaching.com. There's more than just one-on-one coaching. Of course, that's our primary business. We do very highly personalized, interactive coaching between athletes and a range of different coaches that will suit the personality and style that you're after. Programs are for sale on our Training Peaks library. And we have the RPG community where Clint and I and the other coaches are posting very, I think it's informative posts that and people can ask questions there. And it's super, super cheap to get on board and be part of the RPG membership. Nerd belts, the absolute best running belts as created by the man, Steve the Lizard McKenna. Go to nerdbelts.com to check them out. And finally,
Cable Beach Triathlon. One of those events that every time they put stuff on the socials, you look at and go, that would be an awesome one to go and do. August 30 or early September. Get amongst it. Book a flight, get over there and experience something completely different on the Australian triathlon circuit.
Back to the show. Paul Belder is on the show today. We're on Triathlon Therapy for episode Nobody Knows. We don't keep track. Paul is, I've got to say, I've hung out with A-list celebrities, Hollywood celebrities. I've never once been nervous about hanging out with them. Now that I am an absolute MMA frother, this is the first time I've ever done an interview where I'm actually a little bit nervous. I am not even going to try for a really good introduction because anyone who watches MMA know that anyone who's been introduced by Bruce Buffer, I'm just going to be a complete letdown. But Paul is now a competitive age group triathlete, one of the best lightweight MMA fighters in the not so far distant past, known as the Irish Dragon. We are just fascinated to have Paul on because one, Clint and I absolutely love MMA, but we're really, really curious to see what the crossover's been like between triathlon and MMA and to get a good insight on that and also to have a legend of the sport and also now a great commentator in the MMA on board. So thanks, Paul, for coming on.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, man. You know, I appreciate all the kind words, but I'm obsessed with this new venture and this sport, just like you guys are getting into mixed martial arts. So it's all mutual. And that's why I love doing podcasts like this with you guys who know far more about endurance sports and the world of triathlon than I do. So I'm going to pick your brains as much as you guys get to kind of hear the ins and outs of fight nights and what's it like backstage and how the crossovers have happened. But it's been great so far. And I just got done running as well. So plenty to talk about and how crappy I'm feeling towards the end.
before Clint gets stuck in, one thing I'm quite perplexed about is I can't work out whether your hair is brown or red. Because early in the career, it looked quite brown. And then whenever I watch you commentate, I'm like, no, he's definitely a redhead.
So, yeah, I mean, I have red hair, but it gets darker if I have any like gel or product in it for a broadcast and things. My beard is always really red. And when I was a little kid, I was a redhead. I got made fun of, you know, I was ginger as through and through as you can get when I was a little kid. And you know, as you get older, your hair changes. I've got a lot more grays in there than I used to as well. Thank God you can't notice that as much with red hair, but under the lights in particular, the shorter my hair is, when I was fighting, if I had shorter hair, those lights, I mean, they're right above us and they're bright as shit. So that would sometimes make even my beard or my hair look like firecracker red.
I think you're a victim. I'm in the same boat. Once you grow that beard and it's, flaming red, then your hair just gets.
Love that you say victim.
We are. We're victims of the red beard, then translates to red hair. So,
Danny is too. Our host Paul is has a red beard at the moment, so he would have loved to come on and shown you it. But did it, what age did you start this stuff? Did it start with the whole? Did it start with a beard at like 10 years old and someone picked on you and then and then the fighting started?
Oh man, I did. You know, like I grew up in a pretty rough neighborhood in South Philadelphia. Anybody that knows the Rocky movies and all that kind of stuff, that's kind of the area that I grew up in, only like an even dingier part of that. And yeah, you did. I mean, kids make fun of you. When we'd be playing sports, I always got in the scraps. I always had a bit of a temper when I was younger. That's why I got into martial arts to begin with, was to sort of help kind of ease that. My mom was all about it. Once I got obsessed with Jackie Chan, the Ninja Turtles, Power Rangers, like all that stuff. I was doing that in backyards everywhere I went. And I actually started begging for karate lessons, or I called them kung fu lessons at the time, because I was obsessed with Jackie Chan. I didn't know, you know, when you're a little kid, you don't know the difference between judo, taekwondo, muay thai. You don't know what the hell it is. You know, there's kick punches, spinning stuff. You wear a cool uniform, and that's what I wanted to do. So I fought a lot in the streets as a youngster, and then that kind of all really stopped once I got into martial arts. I got really competitive at a young age in taekwondo. I had a really badass instructor when I was a kid, Sal Sandone, shout out to Sal, that ran the karate program that I started out in when I was little. And he was a tough guy from South Philly as well, who got really close with this grandmaster from Korea, South Korea. And from there, man, he kind of definitely got the competitive juices in me flowing at a young age. He would take me to all these tournaments. My uncle was really on board with it. We would go to a ton of tournaments. So instead of going the more traditional sport route as a kid, like 12 years old, I started getting obsessed with martial arts. So all that other stuff, soccer and football and baseball, all kind of got put on hold to pursue martial arts at a young age. But I was always a scrapper. You know what I mean? Like if a kid started crap with me in the street, I wasn't quick to hold back to start throwing hands when I was young. Much calmer now, guys.
Well, that's because you're training all the time and you don't get, you're probably tired 24/7 with the endurance.
Remind me not to cut you off on a run if we ever jog together.
So speaking of which, like we'll talk fighting the whole way through this, but we'll try and keep it a little bit of fighting and triathlon. What have you learned from your time in triathlon or endurance sport that you wish you knew early on in your fighting career, where you're like, oh, I really wish that would have really helped me as a fighter?
Oh man, a lot of things, right? But there is something that I now preach to a lot of my friends that are still competing. And I try to tell them this without sounding like, you know, whenever your buddies get into something new, they're always like, oh man, you know, you got to go keto, bro. Or, oh, you got to start eating carnivore diet. Cause I am, right? You don't want to be that guy. So I've been trying to kind of give them some advice on endurance and how they can build their gas tanks a little better and not deviate from being a fighter. You don't have to run a marathon. You don't have to do this, but you can incorporate these strategies. And it's the easy stuff that I think not enough fighters are doing. They're not taking the days that are long and consistent, but they're not battering their bodies. Like going on an hour and a half to 2 hour run, even more, 2.5 hour runs if you're getting ready for a long race. You don't do those all at threshold pace, right? We don't do that all trying to kill ourselves. We do that going with a buddy, chat it up most of the time. And I try to tell these guys, I'm like, you guys need to be doing more of that to strengthen your legs, to strengthen your overall base, to get your heart stronger. And in MMA, it was so all about like, and I was a victim of it too. Like, you gotta go now, like hard. Kicking hard, ground and pound hard, five-minute rounds over and over and over again. But they end up being shorter workouts and super intense workouts. And what are we all trying to do as fighters? We're all in weight classes. We're all trying to lose weight. Well, what the hell is a better way to lose weight than on the days that aren't intense? Go do a 5-hour bike ride and don't kill yourself. Just eat, burn calories. And at the same time, you're building your aerobic base to go those 25-minute fights. You still have to work on the explosiveness, right? You still got to be able to throw that 4-piece combo with a kick and then be super strong in the middle of that if a grappling exchange works out. But what's going to support all of that is a better engine. So that is the one thing that if I could go back, I always thought I had to go hard. Even when I was doing like my treadmill runs, it was always uphill sprints. But
yeah,
I was never building the aerobic base.
Yeah. The one thing, I mean, as a, you know, a clueless observer of MMA, I'm always curious as to why there isn't more periodization throughout the year. I mean, I guess because a lot of your fights get announced with not a heap of time, but I mean, even you fought for the title at one point, but it was on like a week's notice, I think, or maybe it was the interim title, but
never fought for the belt.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. But I was
almost fighting for the belt and they said I wasn't ranked high enough. It was in Brooklyn years and years ago. So
okay.
Through the New York Athletic Commission.
Right. So the periodization I find really interesting. Like if you knew you had a fight in 3 months, you know, exactly what you said, I'd be like working, okay, let's get the weight down to a level for before camp that I know I can not be stressing my body at too much of a caloric deficit for so long. And then you're bringing in more explosiveness as it progresses closer to the fight. But would that be something, you know, if you did it again, would you want more of a time frame on, okay, when am I fighting? And then you could plan it out sort of differently.
Of course, right? You always wish to have more time, right? We're always hounding the matchmakers and getting on the phone with our managers and being like, what's next? We're always wondering what's next, like anything, right? Any sport. That doesn't have a schedule, you just kind of want to know what's next. Boxers are the same thing. And that's always the question, even after you get a big win. Okay, well, what's next? Oh, forget what I just did. What's next? but you generally get, if you're a high-ranking guy, right? If you're somebody that's in the top 15, top 10 in particular, top 5, God forbid, you don't have to be taking these short notice fights. You might get a massive opportunity you can't turn down. But more often than not, you've got 2-3 months. Thing is, man, it's such a slippery slope as a weight class athlete, right? So when I first started fighting professionally, I probably walked around at about 175 pounds, pretty lean all year round. And then I would cut down to 155. I don't know what that is in kilos or anything like that, but the
70, 72.
And the more you diet to make that weight class, the more you start to have to restrict and starve yourself. The longer you train, the more you lift, the bigger you start getting. And then the binging starts, right? So I would get done a fight after cutting 20 pounds of water or whatever it was to make 155. And I would be so depleted and so desperate, craving for sugar and fat and all the things I couldn't have, that once the fight was over and done, I would go and be a mess. I mean, eating bags of like Halloween candy and pints of ice cream every night, going out with my brother and drinking tons of pints of beer and doing all. And I'd get up to like 200 pounds. And then I would get a couple of fight and I had to work my way back down. And then I'd get super lean, like 4% body fat at weigh-ins, looking like I was, you know, put into like solitary confinement for 3 months. And then it would just start all over again. So the one thing I would say that I would go back and definitely do is I would be more consistent year. And I know it's so easy to say this, but when you're in it, it's hard, right? You get cravings, but I would stay more consistent and do the easy work. Like we're talking about, that should be your all year, all the time stuff. Then when you book the fight, then the hard sparring starts, then the explosive strength and conditioning and all that starts, but you could keep yourself fit and ready to take a fight if you're doing road work, if you're doing aerodyne and bike work and doing a little bit of lifting and maintenance on your body and not beating the crap out of yourself and sparring every day and saving it. That's the other thing I would do too, is I would save the hits to the head a little more for the fight night and a little less in the room. A competitive guy, you're in a room full of alpha competitive guys when you're in MMA. So sparring, sometimes we get a little, you know, getting knocked out, guys getting knocked out and concussed. And, you know, I would do that a little easier. I'd go a little harder in the training and a little easier in the sparring.
So with this being, you know, a pretty hard sport physically as well, what's the motivation now to keep pushing? You know, I don't know if you can tell us if it's harder or, you know, obviously we don't get hit in the head, but there's there's other
could have fooled me, to... Steve.
Yeah.
There's other maybe parts. In the swim. Maybe in the swim, you guys, yeah, you yeah. pros are getting hit in the head for sure.
Yeah. Dude,
I tell people now, and all the guys that I train with, and they I've taken some guys on bike rides. Sean Brady, who's a pretty top, I think he's number 7 or 8 welterweight. He just got matched up with Gilbert Burns coming up actually in a main event. He is a freak, this guy. And I take him out on bike rides and stuff. He appreciates this kind of training. And I'm like, dude, the feeling you have at the end of a trial, like if you really have pushed it and are trying to really close out on that run, man, it's miserable. That's some of the worst physically I have ever felt is on the run of a 70.3 where you're crushed. That's why I look at you pros and I'm like, you guys blow my mind at the paces and ability that they can keep it. I'm obsessed with that, right? I'll never quite be there, but it really has given me something to stay physically active and motivated in retirement. Right. And it also probably allowed me to retire at the right time. But I would say, man, they're different, Steve. Like they're both hard in such different ways. I think as far as physically draining though, just absolute nothing left to give. I think a triathlon, honestly, because it's all there is, right? That's you can't win by finishing the race in the swim, right? It doesn't work that way. Well, in a fight, I can go out there and I could choke the guy out in the first 30 seconds or knock him out. But as far as recovery and like damage, MMA, I mean, I've spent a week in the hospital after a fight with a collapsed lung and needed surgery to heal it. Like a broken, your face in New Zealand, my face is out to here. I had rhabdo from that fight. I was like peeing Coca-Cola. You're concussed. My eyes for a while was like, luckily since I retired, it's fixed. But my right eye was starting to like do the Michael Bisping thing where it was kind of like having a mind of its own. So as far as damage and crazy stories to tell, not, I mean, bikes allow for some crazy stories to be told too, though. So
we drink enough to like at some points in the night after a race, I look at Reedy and his eyes are like,
and that's after your race, just because I'm
yeah. But sorry, by my last lap on the run, Reedy looks at me and goes, "Come on, Steve," and I'm like, "What's happened to your eyes?"
So, Paul, I always ask this question because I'm you know, really would love to make triathlon go mainstream and be really TV friendly. And people think I'm joking when I say I feel like there should be some sort of combination of MMA and triathlon into one event, you know, potentially like even if it was just a swim
now
run.
Now we're talking. Now I can go pro again, right? Now.
Even if it was a swim run, where you could just take people out, but you still still the first person to cross the line. So like, you can't be spending too much time doing jiu-jitsu. You just got to quickly submit and move on. How would you, if you like watching the sport and as a fan of triathlon now, I assume and also a participant, is there anything that comes to mind? You're like, this is how I would do it if I was going to make it TV friendly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever I watch broadcasts, I think first and foremost, the technical side of some of these things has to get better, right? When you watch the UFC, one of the reasons that you like it is not just because the fighting is good. The fighting is good, obviously. Some of the best athletes in the world competing, but it's the production value that they put the money into the right people being behind the scenes that you're never going to see. You see their names at the end of a pay-per-view, Zach Candido, Michael LaPlante, blah, blah. These are all my buddies that are running the producing and all that. John Gooden, who actually did it for T100 now, but professional PTO, he did some of their broadcasting and they need more of that. I think really investing into the television side of it will make it better. You need to get the right people to have a vision of how it's going to look and how they can make the bike portion look good. What can they do in between? Where are the interviews at? And I think the more that people with personalities that are funny or extreme come into the sport, that's only going to help it too. Not that people need to be out there talking trash, but I mean,
no, we need that. We need some trash. We need trash talk.
Yeah, I think in the pro level, Yeah, and some guys don't have to, right? Some guys, that can be their thing, that they're kind of quiet, and then you, it's okay to be a little bit brash about it. It makes people want to tune in, especially if it ends up being a battle towards the end of the race. Then all that stuff that gets said, it's like same in a fight, right? Whenever there's been a bit of trash talk and it gets deep into the, you know, into the deep waters in a fight, it makes everyone like, oh, and even the athletes involved are like, oh man, I shouldn't have talked all that trash. I talked all that trash. I was going to gas this guy out in the first minute and a half, and here he is in the fourth round and we're still going strong. You're like, put more some trash, consequences on it.
More trash talk in the triathlon world. I'm all for
more
it.
Trash talk. And I think I'm telling you, just, you know, like feeds cutting out all the time, or oh, this feed's not up, or oh, you got to go to YouTube and it's, oh, it's a link to actually go to this and watch it. It's, nobody's going to do that. Well, you got to also find times to do it live.
When you watch the UFC, like the level of production is obvious in terms of like someone gets hit with something and it's a replay straight away. And through the middle of the rounds, it's like you're getting the best highlights of that round every single time. They never miss with that kind of thing. So like, obviously that costs money, but when you say the production side of things, like, I think it was one of the races that they did on one of the speedway tracks in the US. It was at the start of the PTO. That was like, yeah. And they had one of the NASCAR commentators, and the level of production that day was like next level. And that was like, oh, it's going the right way. And I don't know where it's gone from there.
Yeah. They stopped using that. I remember that. It was good. And then this last one, the women's race at night, you couldn't see the bike.
Yeah, that was like, as a person involved in triathlon, you're like, this is embarrassing.
Like, you guys, know? This isn't it. This isn't it. We're trying to get eyeballs on this sport, and I'm one of them. Like, I'm obsessed with it now. So I you know, my friends get mad at me for bringing this kind of stuff up all the time, because all they want to talk about is MMA, and I'm like, oh man, you know, today when I was out doing my run and I did this, for 6 minutes I was holding this pace and, you know, my heart rate was this. I'm like, man, we don't care, dude. We don't care.
Hey, Paul, then, just so you know, if you're talking that sort of stuff with pros too, we don't care either.
Yeah.
Oh, I know you.
They'll listen, but as long as you listen when they talk UFC or MMA, as long as you listen then, they'll listen to your stories about them. So what's the ultimate goals in triathlon, Paul?
Well, I mean, I would definitely like to win my age group at some of the bigger, like, Ironman races. I've gotten on the podium for my age group and been in like the top 15 of a race. And then some of the more local ones, I'm like, just, I'm sniffing the leaders, but can't quite get that number one spot at these like local Olympic races quite yet. I'd like to win some local races, and I'd like to qualify for Kona someday and go race that stuff. This is the first year I'm doing my first full, starting with Lake Placid, which was, jumping in the deep end right off the bat. But I've done a ton of 70.3s at this point. I want to do the beast. I want to know what everybody's talking about. You hear everybody always talking about the run on a full and.
Oh, you mean the walk?
Yeah. Yeah. Don't say that.
No. Well, it won't be for you. For many, it is.
Oh, it will be. It will be. I mean, getting out of the water is always a win for me at this point. That's the real challenge.
So, I haven't really talked about this too much, Paul. But I used to go like months without drinking, or you know. I used to be so disciplined leading up to a race, and then I would go full John Jones, like 7 to 10 days out. And I don't mean in terms of the performance enhancing drug stuff. I mean more in terms of suddenly I would have drunk 20 beers just because the pressure of the race would just get to me, and I'd sort of succumb to it. And then often I would have my best race ever, like or 2 weeks later. How did you handle the pressure? And I'm not recommending that to any kids listening, by the way. It was definitely not a good way to cope. But I was never great with like the race pressure. when I'd put months into it, if I'd been away on a training camp, away from my kids, and it would all just get too much. Were you good at handling the pressure of a big event, be it triathlon or fighting? How did you do it? And if not, yeah, I'd be interested in that too.
Yeah, it's tough, because it's one thing to have an event coming up, right? Something you're training hard for, but for fighting, it's such a weird, you've got this fist fight on the calendar staring at you every day that you think about, okay, 10 weeks out from when I have to go to this event and try to knock this guy out in X amount of months. And at first it's extremely exciting. You book the fight, the fight's signed. You're like, yes, let's start. You get the ball rolling. The first couple of weeks is kind of like invigorating. Like, okay, and things pick up in the gym. Now you've got a goal. Now you've got a person. There's a game plan. Now we're starting to strategize. But I'm telling you, usually about 3 weeks out, I couldn't sleep. You start getting hungry. Now the diet's starting to get more and more intense. I would go away from my family, and I would do a lot of my training camps towards the end in Milwaukee. Not in the Midwest. So I wasn't anywhere near my family. I'd be living at some points in like the gym office that they turned into like an apartment. But as far as the pressure of like the event and the night of, I always had a good sense of trying to find things that motivated me. And I would always have a good sense of like trying to find the things that I was fighting for. And it would always change fight to fight. My daughter, Ashling, was always a big part of that. At one point my dad got sick. He was going through chemo and he had cancer. I would always try to find something that was bigger and far more important than me just going to having a fist fight. And that always helped me get through it. And I feel you on the drinking and all that kind of stuff. I would always do the same. I would not touch any of that stuff leading up to a fight. And that was the other thing, that once it's said and done, that's why I would go on my benders after the fight, not before. But John Jones, made a career of being out in nightclubs and doing cocaine and then going and winning big fist fights. So
yeah, I'm just going to clarify. I didn't do that. Yeah.
Just in saying that, Paul, like you say, you'd come up with the reason, like something bigger than you or the reason why. That's something that I say to nearly every athlete we coach for an Ironman, is like, if you can have that reason why and have it narrowed down to just some small little sentence in your head, when you get halfway through a marathon and you get that voice of like, why am I doing this? Well, if you've thought about that for the last 3 or 4 weeks, then the answer when, why am I doing this? You normally have that answer, and it makes it a lot easier to, as Steve said, walk the marathon.
No. It's tough though. If you got a good life and nothing hard's happened yet, for me, like, pretty sheltered still, I have to like suffer and just go, oh, you left Dudley at home for like 10 hours the other day. Come on, just do it for your dog.
No, it's funny though, because some people just have that desire to do that, right? We're all in this or in any of these types of sports because there's that thing inside of us, right? And we're all different from all different walks of life, and why that's there or how we became who we are and need to do this kind of stuff. But anybody that I meet that's into endurance sports, ultra running, hardcore bike racing, it doesn't matter, MMA, something drives us to push beyond what most people are willing to do. And I think that's what excites us. I know that's what excites most of the guys that I'm friends with in MMA, right? Is most people, especially, well, now it's becoming more popular with jiu-jitsu and UFC. But when I was first starting it, when I mentioned that I was an MMA fighter, they still brought up, oh, the human cockfighting, is because John McCain one time called it human cockfighting. They would be like, oh, this stuff with the no rules. And I'm like, well, there's rules, but it just doesn't look like there's that many rules.
Most Australians won't know that cockfighting means two birds fighting. They're thinking of something else. Two birds. They're just thinking of two guys having a sword fight.
Whatever floats your boat.
Totally different fight. Totally different.
That's not a fight.
That's a party. Yeah.
In terms of the specifics of your training now, Paul, like obviously you'd be very busy with the commentary gig that you've got and just life with the family. Like hours a week, schedule, how do you go fitting it in with life?
It's tough when it's tough, but most of the time I'm pretty blessed because since it is commentary, if I'm not working a particular week or a couple weeks in a row, I'm at home hanging out with the kids, helping get ready for school. We got two dogs, stuff around the house, things like that. So I can fit in on weeks where I don't have to actually travel. I mean, like 18 to 20 hour weeks of training has pretty much been the last like 4 or 5 weeks has been anywhere from 18 to 20. When I'm on the road, if I'm in Vegas, I have a bike that I keep out there. So it's not too big of an issue, but like I'm going to Louisville next week. I don't really know what the training, usually what I try to do is jam pack the front end of the week with swimming and biking. And then you can always run no matter where I go, right? I can fit in a bunch of miles on treadmills or if there's anywhere to run outside. So, if we're in Abu Dhabi, that's the only other problem is if it's 120 degrees Fahrenheit, it's tough to get outside for any runs there.
So you don't travel with like your bike and a travel trainer?
I do.
Or something?
I have, man. I've been crazy enough where if I'm gone for, 5 or 6 days and it's reasonable flight where I know I can pack it and it's not going to get lost, I'll bring that with like the feedback roller.
Yeah.
And just, I won't even bring the front wheel sometimes. I'll just know that I'm only doing indoor rides in the hotel room. I've done that. I brought it to Paris with me a couple years ago because I had a race the next week. And I was like, you know what? It'll be worth it just to get, even if I get two good solid rides in the week before the race. Because that's right when you'd normally be hitting a couple last pretty hard workouts before I big, tapering into it.
For sure.
I could, man, I'd bring it everywhere. I love, whether it's on the trainer or out, I love riding the bike. And that's probably the most, it's weird because I don't know if you guys remember, I was having a lot of hip issues. I basically don't have any cartilage left in my right hip from all the years of kicking. So the bike is actually the funkiest thing for me because it's almost like when I'm sitting on the saddle, it's almost as if I sit on the saddle with my lead leg forward, like I'm in a fight stance. It's really taking me a while to try to get my pelvis and like hips to adjust. And because of that, my right leg is like a couple mils shorter than my left leg. So I've got a big shim under there and everything to kind of, it's a pain in the ass.
I'm the same from all my cockfighting. That's where Danny is right now. He didn't come today.
Oh, Steve's the same because he's cockfighting. He always had his hips forward. So
he was a very forward cockfighter, not a very defensive.
He had to be. Hey, Paul, we really appreciate you coming on. We're going to keep this short and sharp. I think it's just cool also, as a retired pro myself, I think it's really important for athletes out there to keep a challenge going, especially physically. Like I've retired and then didn't really do much of any physical activity, and now even just doing marathons is enough that I'm back inspired and feeling healthy. And so I think it's just a great example of what especially fighters seem to struggle as much as anyone when they retire, right?
Yeah, there's just not much. I got so lucky years ago when I kind of got the opportunity to start doing the broadcast side of things because, you don't know what you'll end up doing if it hadn't come my way. But so many guys that don't get that opportunity, don't get to work for the UFC once they're retired. So they have to fight a lot longer than maybe they would even want to. And it is tough. And that's why I'm out here being like, hey guys, there's this other sport that you can just get yourself a bike and you'll keep yourself as busy as you want to keep yourself. Yeah. You can train all the time if you need to.
I always say that to Reedy.
Up for a long distance race. And
I always say that to Reedy in terms of like, if you're retiring or if you're getting retired in triathlon, you just go from winning races to like fifth, sixth, 10th, whatever. If you're getting retired in fighting, it's a pretty gross way to get, you just go and get knocked out every fight. So like getting out at the right time is, pretty cool. But I got a hypothetical for you. The phone rings tomorrow. It's Hunter. And he says, listen, we're getting hounded over and over. Dan Hooker wants to run it back. Mm. You've got 3 months.
Are 6 months. In? 6 months.
If I got 6 months and they're hounding me to come back because he wants it, then we do it. Yeah, for sure. That's what I would come back for.
And then get a new hip afterwards. Yeah.
And potentially a new
arm. On the UFC's dime. Yeah. Don't let them listen to what everything I just said about my hip then. We'll just, as soon as the fight's over, but I've been having some pain, right? Conor McGregor, if he calls too, you know, there's some big fights out there that obviously would get me excited. But other than that,
Well, we know Conor listens to this show regularly, so I'm glad you called him out.
So. Kind of playing on at the Black Forge pub or whatever all the time. Yeah.
Hey, Paul, it's been a real pleasure to have you on. And we're just really grateful and we wish you all the best with your triathloning going forward. Let us know if there's anything we can help out with. We would be more than happy. And Clint and I are both angling to help MMA fighters with their fitness too. So if you know anyone, let us know.
it's definitely a thing, right? It should be something. You guys should start trying to show up to some events and just start handing out business cards.
Stop flicking them into the
cage. I saw you gassed out in the second round there, buddy. Call me. I got to help you out.
Any reason to go. If we can write it off as a work trip to go to UFC events, we're there.
Where are you guys all at? In the same area or all over the place?
Yeah, all over the place, pretty much, yeah.
But all down in Australia?
Yeah.
They're coming back.
Yeah, WA. UF
back there in Perth. Soon enough. But I don't know. Yeah, is it Perth?
Yep.
So are you like that? I know for us it's such a pain in the ass. We basically have to travel for 2 days and then take like a 6-7 hour flight to get to Perth.
Yeah, it's the same for us. I may as well fly to the US if I'm gonna fly to Perth.
Yeah, honestly, the last UFC event in Perth, we looked at going and it would be cheap. Like if there's one in Auckland or even West Coast of America, is probably cheaper and more feasible.
Well, let's fingers crossed then for the Auckland one, man. I want to go back there so bad. I only got to go there when I fought Dan and I spent 2 days in the hospital afterwards. So I never even got my after party that I wanted in Auckland. So if we go to Auckland again, I'll hit you guys up and we'll try to make a trip there. And
you will not have to ask twice.
We'll have a good old cockfight. On that note,
that'll do us. Recording done. All right. We you got some big shoes to fill, Nat. We just had Paul Felder on. We've got Nat Heath, who is longtime triathlete, very handy A-trip triathlete, has completed Kona, and is now heading up TriMob, which is, I'll let Nat fully explain it, but essentially encouraging First Nations athletes to take part in what we would all consider likely the hardest one-day event, sporting event, being an Ironman triathlon. Before we talk about TriMob, Nat, can you just talk a bit about yourself and then in brief, your triathlon journey? Like we chatted about it last night, you know, not a lot of Indigenous Australians take part in triathlon. So it is a bit of an unusual route. And I'm just interested, your background and how triathlon sprung up.
Yeah, cheers, lads. So a bit about me. Obviously, very proud Aboriginal man. My people are the Noongar Mudu Jarra people, so from over in Western Australia. But I actually grew up in Foster, well, just south of Foster, Smiths Lake. And that was probably, I guess, to answer your question, how I got into triathlon. Growing up, I had the opportunity to watch the original Ironman Australia, or I think it was called Ironman Foster Tuncurry, like international triathlon. And we used to go out as kids out to Coomber Park to the turnoff and watch the Ironman, watch Paulie Kurua, and some of the legends of the Ironman. And I was, I guess at a young age, there was a couple of local guys. I was involved with the Pacific Palms Surf Club, and there was three guys from the surf club who did the Ironman. And I think because I knew them, there was like a connect point that if they could do it, maybe I could do it. So it kind of like planted a seed in me as a kid that one day I would do an Ironman. But I really didn't get into triathlons until I was about 25, 26. I had a autoimmune illness called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is when your immune system attacks your nervous system. And end up like with full body paralysis. And the doctor at the time said, you'll never have the same speed, strength, or endurance. And I was playing like first grade football at the time. So I was in wheelchair, I was in hospital, couldn't walk anymore. And I just remember thinking, well, I'm going to prove the doctor wrong, and I'm going to get back to playing first grade football, and I'll do a triathlon as a test of endurance. Because I think the seed being planted as a kid and watching an Ironman as the ultimate test of endurance, I sort of saw triathlon as that test of endurance. So 2011, I did my first triathlon, and that quickly, like most triathletes, became a bit of an obsession. And I wanted to do an Ironman, then I wanted to qualify for Kona, and I wanted to do a sub 3 hour marathon. So I was, pretty lucky. I was able to tick off a few of those things. And I guess like one of the things as a Aboriginal person, I was kind of like a bit of an outlier. Like it wasn't really other First Nations people doing the sport. We've had a few do the sport, and there'd been actually two other Aboriginal men had gone to Kona prior to us. But it wasn't really something that we did as a community. So in 2020, I established TriMob, which was to try to get more First Nations people just into the sport, and make it like, a culturally safe space, and like, I guess, encourage our people to get involved in it, but also to provide an avenue for non-Indigenous people to connect with First Nations people, because there's so many, such a white sport. And like, I remember doing Western Sydney 70.3 in 2019 and just thinking like, what would be the impression we would make if we had Indigenous people out here wearing Indigenous apparel, what that sort of impression might leave on non-Indigenous people who have maybe never connected with First Nations people. Fast forward, like in 2022, we set up TriMob as a club, and now we set it up as a non-for-profit entity as well. And we established at the end, beginning of last year, the IMOB program, which was to provide a structured program where we could support a team of First Nations people to be able to complete an Ironman. And we chose Ironman Australia, which was amazing. We had, six First Nations people do their first ever Ironman just a couple of weeks ago. And I think what's been massive about it is like what it's done for those individuals, what it's done for our community. But I also think it's been amazing what it's done for the triathlon community, because I do think we bring something special and a different energy to the sport. And the one thing that's been fantastic is how much the triathlon community has gotten behind us as well.
Yeah, it's interesting, Nat. Sorry, Clint, you look like you had a question. Okay,
no,
sorry. When you talked about it, we had a chat last night, and I was thinking about the actual build of many Aboriginal people is sort of so suited to triathlon, right? Yeah. Like I remember when I was first starting triathlon, Brett Lee was around and was just like dominating the juniors scene in Australia.
Can I tell you a story about that too? So me and Brett went to school together. He's from Foster, and he was the year below us in school. And Brett, as you said, was a god in triathlon and an absolute weapon of a runner. Like his run was his best leg. And at the school athletics carnival, I think I was in year 10 at the time, which meant Brett was in year 9, and we had the like 1500 meter race, which was the last race of the day. And it sort of like would get like a bit of a build up of all the people, like the whole crowd would sort of watch because it was the last race. And Brett Lee's in this race, and you're like, oh, Brett, the God, he's going to destroy this. And what was interesting, the first four finishers of that race were Aboriginal. And Brett actually comes second. he was beaten by Benji Holden, who was the same age as me, but he ran with Brett based off just football and touch footy training. Mind you, he did play touch footy for Australia. Like, the kid was a freak. He outkicked him in a sprint, and you're like, here's Brett Lee, the god of triathlon, who, like, he does run a lot, super talent, and he got beaten by Benji. And Benji was a good surfer, so he could swim. And you're like, imagine if he migrated his talent over to, like, triathlon as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you talked about the number of First Nations athletes that have finished an Ironman and qualified for Kona. Talk about, you know, how many people have qualified and what the stats are on that. Like, there's some serious genetic talent there.
Yeah, so, like, we, I guess, starting up our Ironmob program, like, a part of it was there's just not many First Nations people that we knew of that had done an Ironman. At the time, we only knew of, like, 8. We've now since found out it's about 13. Now that the next 6 have just done it, so that leaves us just under 20. But we know of, so there's Benny Bowen, who's done Hawaii, Uncle Tony, he did in the 8. It is, which it might have been, like, there wasn't probably many people doing it, so the qualification might have been a bit different. Myself and then Nadine Hunt. And then also Aunty Sharon Bolger qualified, but it was during the COVID year, so never got to do it. So that's 5 people that have qualified for Kona out of, like, 19 people. So, you know, it's pretty bloody good strike rate if you were to look at it statistically. And that's obviously, it's not like what you were doing, Tim, at an elite level, but I guess at, you know, your punter level, like, age grouper who's probably doing 10, 15 hours a week. Like, Aunty Sharon, you know, she's middle-aged, she'd be sort of mid to late 50s. Nadine being a mother, single mother. So, yeah, definitely a lot of talent there when, I guess, we get into the sport. So I guess a big part of what we'd like to do in the future with Trimob is really try to develop a lot of young youth into the sport, because going to what you said, the physical attributes are there, but a lot of our people are like, oh, I want to play NRL. And I used to work with a lot of kids and I'd be like, bro, like, you're too skinny for NRL. Like, you need to maybe rethink your sport.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, it's funny you say that, not the talent that I had, mate. I as an age grouper, I tried for like 3-4 years to qualify for Kona. It took me forever. So,
yeah, and some people try their whole career, right? Like, so their whole Ironman journey and don't get there. So to hear that, that's pretty cool. But just back to what you're saying about the guys doing Ironman in Australia and going, like, I know one of the guys who did it's from Coffs Harbour, and he's really proud of what you guys are doing, and that ends up steadily, and we can only hope that sends waves through the Aboriginal community here, which then back to kids like Brett Lee, they end up getting into the sport because they speak to someone about it, and he went and did Ironman. Like you saw in Foster, I was exactly the same. You go and see the event, you get inspired by it. So if you can send those people back to their community and they speak about it, then, I mean, the sky's the limit, right?
Well, absolutely. And I think you can't be what you can't see. And for a long time, there hasn't been much diversity in the sport. You can even look at it in the women's space. It's obviously still a very much a male-dominated sport. And with the more women you see doing it, the more women want to do it. And it's the same for First Nations people. And when I started this program, I had to kind of beg people to be a part of it. Like, no one was, like, that keen on going and doing a 3.8K swim, 180-kilometer ride, and 42K run. And so I really had to break it down. Like, we're going to build you up over 18 months. It's not like tomorrow, but there was a lot of anxiety around doing that. And then fast forward, after just seeing people, our group hadn't even finished the Ironman yet. We had an application process this time for the next IMOB group. And then there was over 30 people applying. So then what happens next year? Maybe it's over 60 or it's over 100. People start to, because they see other First Nations people doing it, they then believe they can do it. And then you get kids who are like, oh, I want to do triathlon now because my mum and dad do it. And, you know, Clint, my understanding is, like, your dad did triathlon. So, you know, the fact that your dad was in it then gets you involved in it. And that will be the same effect that, you know, we'll have with us. And Rob Briggs, who you were talking about from Coffs Harbour, his young fella come to the New South Wales Club Champs this year, but came as a volunteer. And they're like, which club are you involved with? And he was like, Trimob. Like, So that might, he's now getting into cycling. So maybe next year he does his first triathlon. So those are the sort of ripple effects that we're having.
Love it.
So Nat, you've qualified for Kona.
As you said, very surprisingly.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. For those wondering, I do coach Nat. But it just goes to show how freaking talented Nat is. And because I don't think I've seen anyone ever qualify for Kona with so little running leading into an event, you know, with some calf issues. So, yeah, I was pretty shocked. I said, just go out, have some fun, and not going to be a good day was basically my instructions. And then Nat
so much belief.
And then Nat goes and qualifies for Kona anyway. It must be a tricky balance, like on race day, trying to manage yourself when you've got your head in the game with so many other people.
Yeah, I would say the race day is the easy part. The lead up to the actual Ironman is difficult. If you're looking at it at a personal level, like what I'm doing is not what you want to do if you want to have your best race day. Like the days leading up to the Ironman, like you're kind of running around. We've got different little sort of functions we're attending or trying to manage or create. I remember on Saturday by lunchtime, I was like, absolutely like cooked. I was like, tomorrow is going to be a bad day for me because it just on your feet all day, constantly communicating. Like I'm a bit probably like Steve McKenna. I enjoy communication, but you know, after like the 100th conversation, which is a similar conversation that you've had with 99 other people, you're kind of a bit exhausted. But I actually think on race day, I get a lot more energy on the fact that I've got like a group of people out there, and it's not necessarily about me. Like I had at Ironman Australia, my worst ever swim. And probably historically that would have been, if it was just about me, that would have eaten me up, and I would have like done something stupid on the bike and tried to like override for the first 60K. But for me, I was just like, well, today's not about me. Like me finishing's just a win. It's about the other guys, and seeing them finish will be the ultimate goal. So I actually think that led to me having a better race because I was like more energized and kind of more in a positive frame of mind. And you've talked about it a lot, Tim, like a happy athlete makes a better athlete. And I think I was just happy for the whole day. Probably not the last 20Ks of the run. Wasn't heaps happy, but that we got through it. But I actually think, yeah, like I really enjoy it and get a lot more energy out of it, seeing those guys do well. And yeah, like I think what was really cool about the day was probably two-thirds of all the supporters were yelling out up the mob or go try mob. And then just to see those guys out in course, I think the only thing I get really anxious about is like, are they going to finish? And so you're like out on the bike, instead of having your head down, I'm like checking to see, okay, there goes athlete one, athlete two, athlete three. And I'm like, yes, they're all on the bike. Like they're out of the swim. I can relax a little bit. So that's probably the only thing I get a little bit nervous about is just making sure that they're all good on the course. And if they weren't, I'd probably stop and try to make sure they're all good.
It's exactly what we spoke about with Paul, who was just on before you, Nat, is like, if you have that reason why, like, and if you, so, and it can change for people for every race, right? Like sometimes it's, you know, I want to prove something to myself, or I want my parents to be proud, or whatever it is. But if you have that reason why you're doing it, then when it gets a bit pear-shaped, or if things don't go your way, or if it gets hard in the marathon, when you say that why, you've got the answer. Yeah. So you've got the ultimate why, specifically when there's all those people out on course, right?
Absolutely. Like your purpose is huge, your why. And if I look back in reflection, like I guess when I qualified for Kona the first time, 2015, super driven, but from a very selfish individual level. And that was fine for a while. I was younger, hungry. But by almost 2016, I remember the last time I did at Ironman Australia, I was like halfway through the marathon, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. Like I was done. My purpose and drive, because my goal was Kona, I'd done it. So I didn't really feel like I had a purpose anymore. And really then, I guess, fast forwarding and getting back to, you know, where we are today, I did Busso last year, didn't have a great race, but I made sure I finished because it sets an expectation for our, you know, tri mob in our community. Like when you start something, you finish it, even if it's not how you wanted it to go. Like that sends like a bigger message to people, like how do you deal with, you know, circumstances in life when it doesn't go the way you want. And then I guess coming to Port Macquarie, it's like the purpose is much bigger. This is showcasing First Nations people to Australia and to the triathlon community, but then also to our own community. And there was a Koori girl who messaged us on Instagram after it. And she just said, I was cleaning at the triathlon. And she said, I was in tears just watching all the different people just carrying the Aboriginal flag across, because she's probably lived in Port Macquarie her whole life, but never seen anything like that. And that's where it's like, it's a much bigger drive, because it's not just you as an individual, but you're influencing and changing the perception of people all across Australia, both First Nations and Australians too. And that gives you a much bigger purpose. Like when the last 20K, you're like, I just want to stop and walk. You're like, you can't stop and walk because, you know, you're representing not just you, not just your family, not just TriMob, but First Nations people across Australia.
Hey, Nat, I'm conscious of time and also conscious of time, Manny, because I know my kids are all up and just coming in and out of the office. But I think it's really important to explain to people, there's a level of ignorance around the effect of, say, the Stolen Generation. Because and how it can lead to intergenerational trauma. Can you sort of explain to people that might not be aware, and honestly, like even up to maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I didn't really understand why, like I understood how bad it was, but I didn't quite understand how it could just lead to this continual effect for so many generations. Can you explain, you know, I guess for some people who maybe not even, you know, international listeners, talk about what the Stolen Generation is and how it has led to this, you know, potential trauma for, decades and decades and decades.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of complex issues, I guess, within Australia and past policies that have impacted and continue to impact First Nations people. And the Stolen Generation is one of those. And essentially what it was is, for those that have never heard of it, who are overseas, there was a policy really from the early 1900s to essentially 1969, which was to remove Aboriginal children away from their families. At the time in Australia, 1901, when the country was founded, they had like a white Australia policy. They were trying to create really like this perfect Anglo society, and Aboriginal people were seen as a problem with that. So there was this idea that Aboriginal people who were classed as what they called full bloods would die out, and they would then try to breed out Aboriginal people. You'd have only Aboriginal people, I guess, marrying and having children with non-Indigenous people, and eventually you'd have no trace of Aboriginality. But the huge effect, obviously, when you remove a child who's, just a kid and remove them from the family, you're dislocating them from country, you're dislocating them from, obviously, your family, language, culture. And, you know, Tim, you're a father, Clint, you're going to be a father. You can only imagine the anguish that you would have, like, if your child was removed and not having that connection. And the personal connection for me, so is my great-grandmother came from a town called Waluna, and she was removed as a child when she was 2 years old with her two sisters. And for those that have ever seen the movie Rabbit Proof Fence, Waluna is a Western Desert community. That's same sort of family group as in Rabbit Proof Fence. So my great-grandmother was taken to Moorabbin Native Settlement. Her two sisters escaped and actually did the same walk back to Waluna, but because she was two, she was left behind. So she grew up, ended up being trained as a domestic servant, which is essentially almost like, I guess, slave labor. They didn't really get paid. She ended up working as the domestic servant or cleaner for A.O. Neville, who was the chief protector of Aboriginal people. And that her whole life was controlled. Like if she, because she wasn't getting paid a wage, there's old records where she would ask, can I have a pair of shoes? And they would then write to like the state going, should we give her a pair of shoes, even though she's working? And they would decide no. So like their life is not great. But she ended up, she had three children, one of them being my grandfather. They lived in Fremantle. But she died never reconnecting to her family. She never found out who her mum and dad was. She didn't even find out, you know, where she was originally from. And you can only imagine the impact that would have had on her not knowing who her parents were. But it wasn't really until like 20 years after her death that Auntie Joan, my grandfather's sister, found out where our her mother had come from. And for, I guess, our family, so finding out from Wiluna, but we've never reconnected as far as living back in Wiluna. Like, we don't speak Mutu language. And the ongoing impact that's had, I guess, if I look at my direct family line, is so like my grandfather, he ended up leaving home at 13. He became like worked merchant seaman, but probably like a functioning alcoholic. He then had my father. He passed away when he was 27. He had drug addiction issues. So that generational breakdown, like the splitting of what happened to my great-grandmother, even the life of what my great-grandfather went through, he became a very hard man. And that sort of then peels down. And my father passed away when I was 11 months, but so I don't really know what would have been going through his head, but I imagine he had an identity issue. Like, he didn't really know who he was because he wasn't raised by his father. So that what then happens is there's a disconnect at my great grandmother's line. She doesn't know who her parents are. My grandfather moves away from his parents at a young age. He's then not a great father himself. He doesn't raise his children. Then my father, he goes into, unfortunately, like became a heroin addict. He then separates from my mum. There's a disconnection there. So then that comes down to us. So that's my great-grandmother being removed in the early 1900s then has a flow-on effect to, I guess, me today in 2024. So there's a big part of our role, I guess, this generation is how do we, I guess, unravel that and try to deal with that trauma and, I guess, make sure that the next generation, so if I have children, there isn't that break. So we're trying to heal something that happened in the early 1900s today. And I guess that's a big part of what we're trying to do with TriMob too, is we're trying to strengthen our people is at the forefront. Our big goal is around improving our health and well-being. And when I talk about well-being, it's really up in the noggin, like trying to break some of those circuits. And we know the power that triathlon can have, particularly to your mental well-being, but also the strength it can give you as well. So we're very affirmative on like having a strength-based approach, looking at the strengths of our community as opposed to the deficits, and using that as a way to, I guess, strengthen us as individuals and then as a community.
Yeah, thanks for breaking that down. I think it's a real reality check for a lot of people who don't understand, you know, why there is such a gap in health outcomes, in education, and it's like, well, it's not even just, you know, if you don't have parents, you know, bringing up kids, that the outcomes are pretty similar regardless of race, you know, and so that's just and it's just a really it's a sad but great way to actually just explain it to people, because I think a lot of white Australians, non-Indigenous Australians I just think it's good to have that broken down so that they can get sort of come to terms with why, you know, why there is still so much healing to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think the big thing we want to try to do is there's been a disconnect. There's almost like an us and them when it historically with Aboriginal people and Australians. And we just want to provide an avenue where all Australians can actually embrace who we are as First Nations people and celebrate our culture. Like, it doesn't diminish. I think people get like, because Australia is still a fairly new nation, like people almost go, well, like, oh, just because your people lived here for 60,000 years doesn't make you more Australian or me less Australian. And we're trying to show, like, you know, by embracing First Nations culture, it actually adds to you as an Australian. It doesn't diminish your place as an Australian. And if you look at what they've done in New Zealand, where the Maori culture is a big part of their national narrative, we're trying to provide a space where, like, this can be a part of our national narrative, but it adds to you as an individual, doesn't take away from your place as an Australian.
For sure. Just to wrap up, Nat, what can people do if they want to support TriMob?
So there's a couple of ways. As a triathlon club, you can join us. So it's Indigenous led, but it's open for everyone. So you can come what we call cousins of the mob. So you can come be a cousin of the mob and join. So the other thing that people don't know is you can join our club but still remain a member of your club. So you can actually have secondary clubs. So give Clint an example. If he's a member of Coffs Harbour, he can still be a member of Tri-Mob as well. So that's one. You can obviously donate to us. We're, as a charitable organisation, we run on very limited dollars, so there's the ability to donate. You can wear our apparel, so buying our products, so you can go to trimob.org, wear our gear. We always get the ask the question, can like non-Indigenous people wear our gear? Our gear is there for everyone. We want, it's a way of like showcasing and celebrating Indigenous culture. So yeah, head over to trimob.org. We've also like partnered with Win Apparel, so they've got our product on sale as well, as does Budgie Smuggler. You can head to Budgie Smuggler as well and buy yourself some smugglers or smugglets. I think other things too that people can do is reach out. There might be opportunities for us to come do things in your community. If you run a business and you're looking at donating to a good, you know, charitable organization, we're always like open and keen to get more financial support. And I think just being a good ally is also a good thing. Also, you can follow us on Instagram. That's always nice if we can get some more followers. We're try_mob. But I think, yeah, like reach out to us. There's probably opportunities for us to do things in pretty much every community across Australia, which we obviously can't do just yet. But if you think there's an opportunity for you to learn more and maybe go away and do some work with your tri community in trying to get more First Nations people into the sport, like that's a good way that can help us, because our ultimate goal is to get more First Nations people in the sport, which then will help our health and well-being. So yeah, I would say, going back to make it real clear, buy our apparel, become a club member, donate, whether that's $5 or $1 million, we're all ears on that. And yeah, follow us on social media, just get behind us. And if you see us out on the course, what do we say, Reedy?
Up the mob. He's on mute, so I'll hit it for him. Up the mob.
Sorry, I forgot.
Up the mob. Up the mob. And I love, mate, you see that on course now all the time. Whenever you're around that, like whenever you run past, someone's always yelling up the mob. And it's awesome to see.
It's a great catchphrase, yeah. So get behind us. Our kit sort of stands out prominently, so it's not hard to miss us.
Awesome. Thanks, Nat. We will let you go, and we will see you out on the course. Up the mob.
Up the mob.